Today's...
I'm gonna leave it out, so I can cut it up.
Today's November 2, interviewing Edith Nalyak. My topic today is about hunting. And first of all, I was going to ask what you'd like to share about your hunting experiences from your father. The types of hunting he did.
He was a prominent...
What was your father's name?
Vincent Nalyak. We're having Tutu and Makta Quell. We're having interview. So good. We're having a quark and Eskimo food here. It's so good to have an interview like that. Our dad was a prominent polar bear hunter. He hunted a lot. He was a good provider. We were poor, didn't have much, but we didn't go hungry. We never grew up being hungry. Because he hunted a lot. We grew up eating polar bear. Oh, it's just like veal, I think. It's one of the most wonderful food you could ever eat was polar bear.
Did he tell stories of how he would hunt them? How would he catch the polar bear? Did he just use rifle?
He used his rifle. There's a story, he was cutting up a polar bear one day and he accidentally cut himself. And that liver, polar bear liver, is very lethal. It's so strong in vitamin A or something, I don't know. Anyway, the liver, you're not supposed to eat it or whatever. I think what happened was he cut himself and you automatically go like this when you cut yourself. And I think that's what he did, and he got totally sick. He was just, he almost died from the liver of the polar bear. And so, starting from his belly, he started getting white. He was like us, like brown skin. And so, by the time he was 70 years old, he was completely white. I remember him being spotted when we were growing up in Kaktoli. And then going to grade school. It never upset us or anything. It was just a natural, I don't know, process. I have high respects for our dad. He taught us about the good values of living, but hunting, he hunted caribou, seal, but my mom was also a sharpshooter. She hunted, and one time they tested her, and she's got really good eyesight, a really good sharpshooter. So she also hunted seal.
What was your mother's name?
Rhoda. Rhoda Nalyak. R-H-O-D-A. And I remember she always go down, like when the seals are coming in around, just when it's like starting to melt or whatever the ice. And I always remember her going down there, and she would catch one. And one time my brother Lloyd and Edward, I don't know how old they were, probably 11 years old, 12 years old, 11, yeah. They were down there helping her, and she, you know what she did? She took out their belts and tied tied the seal so they could haul it up to the house. And it was in their belts. Mom hunted too.
So your mom mostly hunted seals?
She did. She did hunt seals.
And your dad hunted mostly polar bears?
Polar bears and I remember there was always, food on the table, terrible. Walrus. So they would make fermented walrus. We call it urak. It's really good. Very good. The greener it is, the better. Fermented. And that was a medicine. Even nowadays, my brother Raymond, Jakob, if he has fermented walrus, he has some when he's developing a cold. So it helps.
They would ferment the meat or the blubber?
The whole thing, like when they cut up the walrus, mm-hmm. they wrap it up, not wrap it up, they tie it up. And that's what they call it, and tie it up so it would be like this. Instead, when it's flat, walrus is like that, flat. They take some of that meat off, all of it, yeah. Because when we have urak, there's no meat on it, so they take the meat off. And so after they do that, they cut slabs of the walrus and they get like rope and tie it together, and they leave it, and they say never leave it where the sun go to it, or you can't have the sun because it's going to be bad. You have to keep it in a cool place away from the sunlight, and the best part is that you keep it in a kalisak, never in plastic. Never store food in plastic whatsoever. That's dangerous. And kalisak is good because it's air, mm-hmm. airy, it could breathe, the food can breathe. So that's what we grew up with. Rock. And him coming home with sometimes that terrible stomach. What they do is with the terrible stomach, they take the terrible liver from the fresh terrible, put it in a niuka, we call it niuka, put it in the stomach, the liver, and put it in the ground. Oh man, just I don't know how long they leave it there in the ground, but it gets really good.
When they ferment?
That's a delicacy.
When they ferment walrus, they put it in a caribou stomach?
No. This is different. This is a caribou.
Oh, the caribou?
Yeah.
Our dad
goes out there caribou hunting, and he knows what to do with the stomach, the caribou stomach. Mm-hmm. It's green, like your reindeer, you probably mm-hmm. have. That experience of seeing terrible insights. So our dad would like that. They call it niukak. When they cut it up fresh, it's warm, whatever the body, terrible. They take the stomach out, and then while they're doing that, they cut up the liver, terrible liver, put it inside the stomach. Of the caribou stomach. They call it niukak.
Mm-hmm. Niukak?
Niukak.
Niukak.
Yeah, niukak. And so after that they leave it in the ground, they put it in the ground and store it in I don't know how long. But once they go back and go get it and bring it in, it's just like, wow, the best food ever.
So they would put the liver in the stomach and store it?
Mm-hmm.
The liver?
In the ground. Uh-huh. In the ground. Yeah. This would be...
I bet I tell my good friend Earl he likes to age a lot of Eskimo food in Chivac.
Mm.
I bet he'll find out about this and try it.
It's really good. It's very good. Hunting. Yeah, so my brother Roy takes after. He's a whaling captain right now and he hunts a lot. That's what a captain does, is just a year round, all year round, you have to...
Is that Roy Nagyup?
Yeah, think of the people you're going to be feeding.
He's a captain?
Mm-hmm,
of the whaling
crew? A whaling captain, yeah. And so...
Takes on after your father?
He hunts caribou a lot. Him and his wife just like mom and dad. Flossie loves to go up there and hunt with him.
And what about the fishing up there? You guys set nets and catch salmon? Do they go out?
We never used to catch salmon. We only caught anafia. In Kato Rico, when I was growing up, I remember I grew up with fermented fish. Oh man, that was the best ever. And I had some this summer. Oh.
Was that salmon?
No, not salmon. Kaktak. We call it kaktak. I think it's Chisco.
Oh yeah, it's like a whitefish?
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh man, that's the best ever.
Yeah,
really. The best. The best fish ever to eat, kaktak. And I grew up seeing mom and them putting fish out there, you know, to age it. And I remember doing, they say never let the sunlight. It's the same thing with any Eskimo food, I think, you know. Like they always make sure that the sun wouldn't go on the fish. And oh man, really good when it's aged. And we call it anyway, we age the hot dog. Not urak. Anyway, that's what we do with the fish. They catch them by set netting. And when the ice freezes, they do the ice fishing, hooking. Even during the summer, we rod and reel. And I found out this summer that the best time to really catch fish with the net is when it's really choppy, because the fish can't see, so they get caught in the net. So, oh, okay. I never knew that. So.
They don't catch salmon in barrel.
They do now. They never used to. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there was never any. You know, nowadays we hear salmon.
Hmm.
You know, up there. So,
I'll cut them one.
What about hunting for fur?
Hunting for fur?
Trapping.
Trapping?
Did they use to?
Trap Arctic fox skins, yeah. They used these for money long time ago.
Are those wolves?
No, they'd be. White fox. Yeah. And then Wolf, of course, and Amarok and Kavik, Wolverine. Wolf is Amarok and Wolverine is Kavik. They use those for rough, to, you know, for the parka, the rough. Mm-hmm.
And do they use the caribou whiskers for that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they won't get, yeah. I remember Dad having one with us, and Mom was really good about sewing Eskimo attire for our dad. This is what he... Fur pants. We call those... Kulitsa. I have a... pattern to make those. Patterns to make those and slippers and mittens. So, I don't know what happened in battle. You know, they say never fight over an animal. Never fight over a whale. Never fight over something that you're going to be hunting and sharing with people. Mm-hmm. And I think they did that one time and they couldn't catch a buffalo, like four years, 5 years, until we moved to Barrow, and that's when we caught that whale. And it breaks the spell. I mean, I don't know.
Break the curse.
Yeah. So they started catching whale after that. Yeah. It's an old picture. This is a different kinds of hunting attire. I remember Dad using these and kulitsaks are, where are they? They're like that, and Mom made those, and she made sure that he was well clothed for hunting. So he would be cold.
So during the different parts of the season, like springtime, is that when they do whaling?
Spring whaling in April, spring? May, yeah.
Do they hunt whales all throughout the whole year up there?
Only in April and
or just
September.
In September?
Yeah. That's in spring whaling. And fall whaling is, there's no ice, open water. We had a really good, successful fall whaling. And we had a quota. And they met all the quota. And they have a really good management of whaling, because they can't go beyond 3-4 a day. If the third one is caught, then that's enough. That's a limit for the day. They did that because before there was hardly any people to go help and cut up the whale. I think that's what happened there. That was a wise decision on the part of the whaling commission to make, you know, that rule, so that they would have enough young men, people to cut up the whale.
Do you know when the whaling commission started? And why they had to start a whaling commission?
They never used to have a whaling commission, I remember, growing up.
And when did they start?
I can't say.
Recently?
I was just... No, not recently. It was like in the 80s?
In the 80s.
Uh-huh. Because I was like reading something in reference to the Whaling Commission, and I don't have it with me at the moment. But
what's the purpose of the Whaling Commission?
Is to keep order, especially when they started establishing CODA. I think, thank God it was established. They, like I said, they keep things in order and...
To stop from over-hunting?
Not over-hunting. The reason it was so beneficial that we had the Whaling Commission and all those intact before the CODA, I think it really helped a lot because we had a data system on whale hunting and everything, and all that stuff helped a lot. Because I remember that day when they said we couldn't whale anymore. It was, I remember men cried, and it was such a sorrowful day. They just watched the whales go by.
Who said they can't hunt whale anymore?
Our federal government.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they started getting really seriously involved in going to meetings, you know, whether they're in Japan or, you know, they are so deeply involved in making sure that...
Is that why a whaling commission was started? To monitor, keep track of whales because of the federal government?
Way back then, before that, like walruses, you know, to, I think before, I think there was a lot of waste before they started, I don't know, just killing for the tusks, and that wasn't good, so I think that's when they started being really strict about them. Well, I remember a walrus commission, you know, because that's not in our values, the real Inupiaq, the Inupiaq values, or the rule, common, you don't even have to talk about it. Or we grew up with the knowledge that you have to respect the animal, the whale, and you don't fight about it. You don't cause any, you just don't. You don't argue about it, it's a gift. And same with, and you don't waste. And you don't waste any animal, caribou, walrus, fish, whatever, you know. So, I think they saw that in the 80s, that's when they really started making rules about waste. And the overkill, I think, on the whales were done by Japanese or some people from, they didn't even know how we were respectfully hunting them, you know, making sure there's no waste or whatever. But I remember in the 80s the people were getting wasteful. It was bad. So I think that was a wake up call for everybody to respect the animal and not, you know, waste. So, when they were hunting, like I said earlier, our mom had always sewn parkas for our dad to go hunting. And I remember baby caribou skin was good too for a partner, you know, inside. A long time ago, before lambskins or anything, no harak, they made parkies out of that. And also before mutton or anything, that's what they had used was a caribou skin inside, and no harak. And what else?
The fur on the inside?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fur in the inside. And so, come to think of it, I was trying to think. They had used caribou skin, I think, a long time ago. I can't remember. Old pictures, looking at them, you know, the old pictures that I see was total caribou. And even the attire was all fur outside, caribou. I have a picture of it of my grandmother, my mom, and my aunt wearing that attire, caribou. So they did use the animals, but one of the awesomest things that our dad told us on the tape was when he was small, he was so well taken care of. They loved him to pieces because they adopted him and they just relished him. And he said one time his mom made him a parka. It's a parka made out of birds. Oh my gosh, isn't that something? A long time ago, he was a little boy, a little kid. And what was the name of the... I've heard that story and I said, oh man. Amazing. They use anything. Isn't that very wise? And they use anything that they can to keep warm, or just to try something like that. I guess I don't know. Maybe they had used it before like that for children.
Or
a bird skin.
Yeah, they used emperor goose and loon.
Yeah.
For parkas.
Yeah. That's what he's talking about. And I was, maybe my mentality was, what did they do with the, you know, that loon thing? So they probably took everything out of the wings and used that.
That's a lot of bird skin.
I remember listening to it and said, oh my gosh, the intricacy, the ability to sew that. You, those bird feathers together, you know, the skin, the bird skin together. So
you said fox was no good?
For inside parka, never been used.
Never been used.
Best is for rough in this condition of like going seal hunting or whatever, polar bear skin would be excellent for it. Because it's waterproof, and like I said, Dad had always had those fur pan.
Is that polar bear?
I don't think it's polar bear.
Looks like
caribou. Wolf. Yeah, it's wolf. Yeah, and caribou. Mucklucks. Yeah. So, I was trying to see. I remember one summer, Mom, even in Cocktail, was teaching us how to catch those little birds. There was a circle, and we put a cloth over it and sew the cloth onto this round thing, and we go down there and like, what do they call it? You, when you look out for it and then you let the stick cut up, mm-hmm. and then you catch a lot of birds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You used to do that.
You used to do that?
In a box, though.
Oh, it was so fun. Some of the things that our parents taught us, it's just like, wow.
You guys used to hunt geese also?
Mm-hmm.
Geese,
eider ducks. We still do.
Ducks.
Mm-hmm. We still do.
What's the best time they hunt, spring or fall?
Spring, let's see. Even when I was up there in July, August, yeah. They come around that time of the year, September.
Do they go and nest up in that area, nesting?
Nesting? There's a big area for lots of birds, even different kinds of birds from way down from somewhere, different countries. That bird watchers go over there and see, because they do have a place where there's a lot of birds, different kinds of birds.
It's up by Barrow?
Yeah, in Barrow. And they, when they nest, there's still some people who go there and get eggs and eat them at home.
Mm-hmm.
They say they're really good in some kind of a vitamin. They have they're really rich in some, I can't remember the vitamins.
We like to dip them in seal oil and eat.
Oh.
With seal oil and salt.
Oh my gosh.
Really good.
Yeah.
Because in Chivac, right where Chivac is, all around us they're nesting everywhere.
Everywhere. Oh,
bad. Nesting ground.
Yeah. Let me get you ice.
Okay, I'll pause this. The question I wanted to ask was about the whaling boat.
Mm-hmm.
How they make one?
Mm-hmm. They go out buried seal hunting first. They make sure they have like 6 or 7. It depends on how big the boat is. The bigger the boat, the more bearded seals they have to catch. They cut it up and they ferment it, the skin. So that the skin would be able to come off really easy. That's how they start. So when that time is ready to make the around March before whaling starts, February, March in the month of March, that's when the women start sewing the baby seal skins together. My sister knows a lot about it, on how to cut the bearded seal skin, how to cut it and how to sew it together. I had an experience of helping sewing one time. Only once I did that. I'm home now, away from Wisconsin. That's my goal, is to be involved in that. Start getting involved and start learning. I know how. I just said it's been so many years ago. So the frame
made out of wood.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain way that you're supposed to, and
all this time I thought they made it out of walrus.
In Barrow they make it out of the bearded seal skin. Walrus is somewhere around St. Lawrence area.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a different area. So they do that. They After the women sew it, the men are ready to put it on the frame. They know how to, they know where the front and the back's going to be for the woman. They tie it up with ropes. And I remember being involved. If there's a hole or something, I was there to sew it. So we make sure the women make sure that there's no holes on the skins. And sew it if there's holes in the skin.
How long would it take to finish sewing up one skin for the boat?
A day.
Just a day? For the whole boat?
There's about 8 women sewing all at once. Mm-hmm. The skins.
And one skin would last how many years? For the boat? Replace it every year? Or it would last?
It costs a lot to do this. Nowadays it's they pay the women who sew, mm-hmm. who sew the skins, and in order to make the boat last longer, sometimes some men, some crew captains paint the skin boat, and it will last like 2 seasons maybe. Yeah, and that's all that paint. That's because it's costly to maintain.
Okay, and then up in the mountains, you guys would, what kind of animals would you catch up in the mountains?
What kind of animals?
Mm-hmm.
Up in the, in Kaktovik where I was born, sheep. Oh man, that's really good sheep. Sheep, and I remember being out there camping with our uncle Perry, and he would make squirrel. It was so tender. Very, very tender.
Squirrel soup?
No, not soup. Sheep soup and squirrel, they just boil it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, they just.
And those sheep are up in the mountains?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They go to the mountains and that's like right before Thanksgiving or Christmas, the men would go out there and make sure that they catch a sheep for the feast, the Thanksgiving feast or mm-hmm. Christmas feast.
Okay. I think I got a lot of information now.
Mm-hmm. This is the boat.
This is Ulrich Oron with my second interview with Edith Nagyak. Today is November 11, and my topic today is walking in two worlds, mixing the Western culture with our traditional culture. And my first question to Edith is that earlier she explained in our class with her culture had to learn how to walk in two worlds. Could you explain?
Explain?
What you meant by that?
My grandfather, Andrew Akuchuk, was one of the first.
Andrew?
Yeah, Andrew Akuchuk, A-K-O-O-T-C-H-O-O-K. He was one of the first Inuvialuits to go to school, including, I remember, Harold Kaviluk, and they started going to these schools so that they could learn how to understand the Western world. With the encouragement of his oldest brother, Fenton Diluc, he went to Barrow, because they heard that there was a school being established there. So he went there and he learned how to speak in English. And that's how he learned to translate the Bible. I think that was his main goal, I think.
Who, your grandfather?
Yeah. He became a lay preacher.
Well, he wanted to go to school to learn how to read the Bible? Or that became one of his...
Probably that was his... I haven't asked, but I do know that he started translating the Bible from English to Inupiaq. So it started out with our grandfather who, with his wise brother Fenton, figured that they needed to understand, I guess, English. Because they were all total Inupiaq. No English. They haven't seen white men at all. So
when they translated the Bible, was it they were translating by word speaking?
Mm-hmm. I have
Or did they write?
I have the old way of writing with me. I'll show it to you later. They do have the old writing. And now, later on, they translated the Bible. This is the old way of writing. Ikayok tiksakak tiwut kadin at kangun. Kilaumlu nunamlu. It's different compared to this writing. This is the this one was translated by the first translated book was by Amawa. He was a preacher.
Cool.
So he translated the whole New Testament all the way from Matthew to Revelation. And this is just the only Inupiaq. There was a thicker one, both in English on the right side and then on the left side English, and then on the right side it was Inupiaq. This is just total Inupiaq. Back in 1980s, I'm not sure, I'm just guessing, I remember they started putting the Q into the language, into the Eskimo language, so that see, and with a tail and Q and G with a dot, and N's and L's, and they started using that because it's like taught in the Inupiaq schools. Inupiaq, when you take Inupiaq classes, they teach you the Atchagaks. Atchagak, that means the ABCs, the alphabets of the Inupiaq. So I guess it was instilled in us to live in two worlds with the knowledge of our grandfather, you know, learning how to live in two worlds. He was the first role model for us. But growing up, we were total Inupiaq. We never, this is our second language. English is our second language. Our mother language is the Inupiaq. So it was easier for us as children because we had an Inupiaq teacher. That was Dr. Harold Kavirluk, whom we couldn't understand what he was talking about in English, because we don't know anything about English. Nothing. And so when we couldn't understand, he would speak to us in our language. I said, oh, okay. So
he was older than you guys?
Dr. Harold Kavirluk, mm-hmm. Yeah. He went to school in White Mountain to become a teacher. So he did his schooling to become a teacher in the early 1940s.
This is Dr. Harold Kavirluk.
K-A-V-E-O-L-O-O-K. Dr. Harold Kavirluk.
He was the first teacher
in Kaktovik. In Kaktovik, that was our first experience of going to school. He was one of the first teachers ever. He was only one person with a one room classroom, and it was from first grade or kindergarten probably. Kindergarten on up to eighth, I think, seventh. So
so he taught in English and when
when we couldn't understand,
he translated.
He talked to us in our language, and I said, oh, okay. So we were fortunate to have been taught by somebody who knew our language.
This was when you were in kindergarten?
Yeah. When I was six years old, I think you would go to the school. That was the, when you were 6 years old, you could go to school. There's a story of my brother. He was less than 6 years old, I think, and he wanted to go to school so bad he would be looking through the window. And so Dr. Harold Kavirluk let him come inside finally after. He wanted to go to school. He's very intelligent, he's very smart. So living in two worlds, we are very comfortable living in two worlds. A couple of James and Mira graduated from Sheldon Jackson Junior College, and they both of them went to seminary school, graduated. They're both reverends. And living in two worlds.
Like in our culture, in Chivac area, when the missionaries came into our area,
mm-hmm.
there's a history of abuse towards the native people,
mm-hmm.
the missionaries did.
Mm-hmm.
Like they would punish them for speaking English.
Mm-hmm.
And so our people would be scared to speak our language.
Mm.
And so when they started learning English and they felt uncomfortable speaking their language, that's why when they got out of school and started having their children, they felt more comfortable speaking English instead of their language.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, that's why, one of the reasons why in our area our people are losing their language, because the parents feel more comfortable speaking English.
It's not so much as being comfortable. In my personal experience, mm-hmm. They had turned our mouth, our able to speak, totally from English back to English. It was a total change. Mm-hmm. 9 months out of the year, going to manage from high school, in my personal experience, not so much that it was more comfortable. We learned it, we speak it, it was just, it just fluent. We never even looked back about we understood mom and dad, we talked to them in Inupiaq, but when we were starting to raise kids, our generation, my sister's generation, she's like 62. You're right, they were being punished for speaking in their language. My sister talked about that earlier too. So, and I still cannot understand why we were abused in fourth grade. This Mr. Clandon, I still can't remember him. He used to slap us on the hand. I don't know whether, did we speak in Inupiaq or what happened? I didn't even learn anything that way. He was abusive, and then I had, Mr. Crawford was excellent, Mr. Johnson was excellent, and boom, another abusive teacher. He was really bad, Mr. Derek, and he got fired. So there was abuse. How many generations down, you know? And so, I think that's what happened in losing our language, was that not so much as being comfortable in talking, it just like a reversal from Inupiaq to English, and that's, we didn't even think about it, we didn't even think about being comfortable about it, it just happened. 9 months over there, speaking total English, only 3 months here at home, Inupiaq a little bit, whatever, and playing outside, or being among kids that came back from high school, it just,
like, took over.
Yeah, it took over. The yeah. English language took over. And so we didn't even realize, I never thought about losing our language back then. It just happened. And so we're paying for it right now.
Yeah. Some of them are trying to...
That's one of my greatest regrets, never talking to my kids in my language, in my Inupiaq language.
Yeah.
Because they don't understand, they don't speak. They might understand. So,
Me, I'm one of the youngest speaking, fluent speaking in Chupik and Chibak. I'm one of the youngest ones who can
talk to them.
But you know, that's why I was like, it's so hard to...
Don't make excuses.
It's like, to me, it's
they
more
They have to know.
Yeah.
They're gonna, like, my kids are so angry at me. And I don't blame them. I could see it in their eyes when we start laughing and talking in our language and just enjoying ourselves, the whole family, they don't know what the heck we're talking about. Mm. So...
I know my grandma keeps telling me to talk to them in Chupik, because they're young, they'll learn quick.
Yeah, they will. Yeah, you have to.
Yeah. And so there's...
There's no question about it. No excuses, no more excuses. You know the language, talk to them.
No, no, in Chivak they're starting an immersion school.
Good.
So where it'll be all Chupik.
Good.
Starting from next year as kindergarten.
Good.
And then is there anything like that up north?
Mm-hmm.
Where they're,
yes.
They're doing
yes,
that too?
Yes, yes.
Like which communities are doing that then?
Every community.
Every community.
See, there's 8 villages. Mm. Barrie is a hub. That's the biggest village. The other 7, like Atkasu, Wainwright, Point Lake, Point Hope, Cocktown, Anakdura Pass, and did I say Point Lake? They all have that immersion program in the schools, and that's wonderful. That is so wonderful. They need to know. They need to understand. They need to learn. They need to understand what we're talking about. So, living in two worlds. I feel okay. Personally, I do, but my biggest regret was having to talk to my kids in English. And we still hunt, we still quail, we still have our dances, we still have our Eskimo dances. And one of the things very, very, very important is that we have to talk to our grandchildren, our children, our mother language. That's the only way that it will not die completely.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to my uncle, Albert Oron.
Yeah, come in.
I was talking to my uncle
Hi.
Albert.
Hi.
And he's about 65, or maybe almost 70 now.
Your uncle?
He's okay. About 70.
Yeah.
He's one of our new up-and-coming elders in Chivac.
Mm-hmm.
He would observe people going out hunting.
Uh-huh.
He has a camp in Gilklevik. It's like a main road of rivers.
Mm. Your uncle?
Yeah, I was talking about my uncle Albert. He has a camp on Gilklevik River, which is a main road of where people go hunting, and he would see people hunting seals, or he would see what time people get up in the morning to go hunting, and the style of hunting they do. He said like this: today these people, they don't know how to hunt, and that's all he said. And I thought about it. They don't know how to hunt. And then he would tell me stories about how he would get up at 5 in the morning and he would take off, go kayak, hunt seals and catch everything or anything he wanted. Every time he went, he would catch something. And then I guess what he meant was, these days these people get up really late, they go hunting late, they zoom by on their boats. While they're zooming, he'd see a seal go under the water. They're going so fast, they take off, the seal would come up.
He's right.
Yeah, he told me he saw that happen right in front of his camp. And,
too fast.
That made me wonder what he meant, so I started thinking about it. People get up too late, they go too fast hunting. sometimes, a lot of times, they'll go hunting and come home as nothing. They won't.
They're too noisy.
Too noisy, too
yeah.
fast.
The machines, mm-hmm. the boat motors.
Yeah.
He's right, you have to take a kayak. Mm-hmm. There's no noise except just the water.
Yeah. And then another story I heard from the late Francis Pinayak was he brought his son out seal hunting. They had their outboard motor boat on the, out on the ice hunting seals on. They were going really slowly to this really big makluk, it's Ugruk.
Yeah.
Really big one was coming towards them. And his son was aiming the gun to shoot, but the seal, that makluk was just skimming the water like this little dot where its head was, and its body was up. And then Francis Pinayak told him not to shoot, so that seal went underwater. And then it came up again same way. And then Francis Pinayak took an oar, and he dipped the oar in the water. The makluk went under, and it came up with its head sticking way up high looking around. And then Francis Pinayak said, go ahead and shoot.
Wow.
So he shot it and he caught it one shot.
Wow.
And stories like this and what older people say about our two worlds, our old traditional way of hunting compared to today, our younger generation, just go up and go for a ride. That made me think that we need to talk to our elders about our hunting skills, and every story they get, we should write it down
yep.
and keep it.
Yes, yes.
So we could learn from this stuff.
Yes.
And that's the kind of stories I would hear about, you know, living in two worlds, about hunting. You know.
And they're too involved in Atari games, Nintendo games, and TV, and all they're interested in is the latest jackets. They don't even know anything about the weather and how you're supposed to catch a whale, or how you're supposed to catch a seal, or how you're supposed to catch any animals around here in barrel, or you know. Yeah. But living in two worlds, technology has helped us. It has given us the ability to like shoot and kill. What's that phrase? Where instant. it's ready? Okay. Instant Kill in Hualien. I remember they were having a big meeting, a Hualien big meeting, and they wanted to improve their Hualien so that they won't have to waste whales. Like sometimes they would shoot a whale and then it would get lost and they would never find it. So they proposed to have a better harpoon, a better gun. So I remember, you know, and technology has done that. I agree with you. Technology is too noisy. The motorboats, the ski-doos, and everything. Our young people need to learn. You can go hunting without the ski-doo. You could walk. They walked a long time ago with a little sled, going down seal hunting. And those are the old ways that they need to learn, that they need to know about the old ways of how did they do it without the ski-doo, how did they do it without the motorboat, and how did they do it, you know, without VHF and CB and four-wheelers and all that. I encourage you to put everything in writing of how they did it long time ago before technology. And so, living in two worlds, we've gotten too comfortable where we are right now, sitting, and we don't have to chop wood, we don't have to chop ice, get water, and where people are having problems with arthritis and diabetes and high blood pressure. There was no such thing as diabetes, high blood pressure, nothing, when we were in the 1940s, 1930s. But we were always so active. No stress, just living off the land, no electric bill, no gas bill. Oh, I have to make that car payment. Oh, the TV is broken, I gotta get a new one, you know. A lot of stuff changed.
Did you have never heart attacks, no strokes?
You know, we were the most agile, healthiest, full set of teeth, really healthy teeth, before coffee, sugar, pop, candy, hamburgers. We were living off the land. That was our food, the natural. No additives, no preservatives, just nature. Animals that we hunt were healthy. Nowadays, they have the Red Dog Mine, and they have these oil fields, and all affecting our land and animals. So living in two worlds, sometimes it makes me so sad that our kids are not learning our old way of life, how we used to survive without electricity and without natural gas, or without a car, without a four-wheeler. And my grandnephew, when before I left here, before I came here, he really made me think so hard about passing down the knowledge of making a fire without matches, how to build a sad house, how to build a snow igloo, how to survive in harsh, cold climate, like those tutu socks, terrible socks, perfect, excellent. You can use those to survive out in the cold weather. How to make those uruliks, the waterproof muklaks. They have to learn how to do all those things. So I've lived in two worlds and I've been away from home. It's really painful to be away from your hometown where your grandkids are, your family. And so living in two worlds, our father, our parents gave us that confidence though to survive in the free, freeway world. I could go out there and drive. That I'm thankful I can. And in Wisconsin I can, like in Milwaukee I can drive in the freeway, which I could never have learned. You know, there's, I don't know, just balancing and give and take. So the best, I liked what you said in teaching your kids how to speak and understand your language and learning the old ways and writing them down. The best thing ever. That would be the best thing ever that we ever do for our grandchildren, our children that are going to be living 50 years from now. They are. That would be our gift. That would be our gift to them, to make sure that they know how to survive if there's an energy crisis. And even if there's no energy crisis, they could go out and enjoy a natural way of life by making a sad house, making a snow igloo, and learning how to make a fire without matches. That would be our gift.
Sounds like a good project we can do by using technology or modern today.
The computer. We could type everything. And then, whoop, it's out there. The paper, it's right there after we type it.
Yeah.
And everything is so easy to do.
It's much easier to write things down.
Publishers. We could have somebody write it down like this. And so here, my child, this is my way of life. Wow, what a gift, huh?
I just got a good idea from you. Is one thing we could do back home is apply for a grant.
Yes.
To
yes.
Build a sod house.
Yes.
Education.
Yes.
Use our elders that we have today.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hire some people to build
a sod house
and hire somebody to document it all down and write it every
mm-hmm.
detail.
Mm-hmm. 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 On paper.
Yeah.
No tape. No tape.
It'll have to be on paper.
No tape.
Yeah.
You could tape it. You could put it on a CD. But once you have it down there, you have to transcribe it. and put it on a book, make a book out of it. Excellent idea, yes. So you have to balance out your life, because being angry with the missionaries and the white people, it's wasted energy. We cannot be angry at them. It's not worth it. We have to take what we have and pursue the preservation of our language and the way we lived a long time ago. Put it in writing. It's crucial. It's crucial right now. Mm-hmm. You got some really good information.
Okay, meeting adjourned.